How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. This is just one of my favorite shows of the year. Might be my favorite show of the year, the Thanksgiving Family Special. And we have Lauren Larson doing the important work this evening for our friend Claude, who has more important things to do. We have my favorite Renaissance man of all time, Nevin Martell, my favorite mixologist, who has many other talents, including a men's book club star, Rodney Ferguson, who has a custom cocktail he's going to tell us about in a minute. And we have one of my all-time favorite Chatter on Books alums, Karen Tanabe, who's coming back to talk to us a lot in just a minute about the Sunset Crowd, which is fabulous. We were just chatting a little bit before we started rolling. Love reading the book, love listening to the book. Fully anticipate there's going to be a Netflix series about this soon. But first of all, welcome back, everybody. Rodney, Nevin, great to see you. How are you, my friends?
Wonderful. Thank you, Tori.
Yeah.
Nevin and Karen, thank you.
Okay, we're waiting for David. Is probably recovering because his beloved American Eagles, and that's what I call them all the time, his BAEs, almost beat Georgetown yesterday. But almost counts. For the American Eagles, that counts. So he's probably recovering from that, but we hope to see him. This is about Thanksgiving. Nevin, I think the first time we had you on the show, it was in my dining room, maybe? My old
it
house?
It was. There was a grazing board and drinks involved.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm kind of wondering if the courier is going to show up at the door of my office with said grazing board and perhaps a cocktail or two.
And lovely Michael Sands of Calvert Woodley used to give us a couple of bottles of wine for every taping, which was fantastic. I called Michael in July of this past year and said, hey, Michael, you know, thinking ahead, Thanksgiving's a great show. We'd love to do it in the store because we've done a show in Calvert Woodley, which is one of the best wine liquor stores in town, probably is the best. And I said, so I'm thinking maybe a week or so before Thanksgiving. I know it gets busy. And he laughed at me. And he says, we're busy from essentially October 1 until after Christmas. So don't even think about coming into the store. But that was nice.
Do you remember
the major issue, Nevin, at that the first time you were with us?
Well, is this the fact that somebody had a turkey that smelled a little off and they wanted to know if they could still cook and eat it?
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of went back and forth on it. It depends on how close to the edge you like to live. I live a little bit closer to the edge. And, you know, ultimately, he did not live anywhere close to the edge. I think the turkey went in the trash, and probably rightfully so, because if anything had happened, you don't want to ruin Thanksgiving.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? And it reminds, I think we talked about the time, one of my favorite things about Thanksgiving is the Butterball Turkey Hotline.
Yes.
Kinds of things that people, you know, the turkey has smelled for 5 days. Is it okay to cook it? No, it is not. That Butterball Turkey Hotline has reached such epic standing in our lives. It's the thread that runs through one of the latest Hallmark movies.
Really?
Yes.
I clearly am not watching enough, if any, Hallmark movies. But doesn't everyone just go to like TikTok and Instagram now to figure out what to do with their turkey?
Yeah. You know, the number gets used a lot. Okay, Rodney, what's the latest and greatest in Men's Book Club?
We've had a very interesting fall. We at one of our members actually has written a novel.
Oh, get out.
His novel was our book.
Ooh.
Now think about that. That's daring.
That's loaded.
Part of the author. It's daring on a part of the participants, who are all his friends, but it was mutually agreed to read the book. I must say, it's fabulous. It's a fabulous book.
Could have been the end of a great men's book club.
It could have been. Yeah. It was a risky, risky maneuver. I will refrain from author and title, but
you don't have to.
It has been the author is a dear friend named Tom Dan, and he is one of the founders and a denizen of Chevy Chase, and he has written a book, and the title is still being massaged a bit, but it is a gothic, sort of southern gothic murder mystery with all sorts of other over and undertones based in Memphis, Tennessee, where he is from. So this is authentic for him. He's not from Stowe, Vermont, writing about Memphis, Tennessee. And I loved it. it was fabulous. And now comes the easy part of finding a publisher, selling them a couple million, selling the book rights, and, you know, then we'll go to Saint-Tropez for the book launch, right?
And we'll have them on the show.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But it really, Tom has labored over this book and done lots and lots and lots of research. He's got, a member of the book club is a professional writer and editor who has had several screenplays produced and books. A lot
good
of
for him. Yeah. Hey, I've never asked you this. Is The Great American Novel in you?
You know, I started it 10 years ago. It's still coming out of me slowly. I have no idea if it's The Great American Novel or just an American novel. It's not so great that nobody will ever read, but I'd love to finish it. It's definitely, I hate this phrase, but it's on the bucket list, you know, between all the other writing. So it's, which is one of the many reasons why I admire our guest today so much, because she is just so prolific and just has such fabulous ideas and is able to put out books at a speed which I can only aspire to at this point in my life. But only I would love to write a novel.
Karen wrote The Great American Novel. We just read it.
That's
right.
What,
hasn't it been done? And here we are.
Again and again.
Hold that great introduction. See, if I were a really good host, I would just roll right through that. But I got to spend 30 seconds and brag about two of our Chatter alums. And I am so, so, so happy for them. Nevin, you guys probably all know them. So Ilion Wu, whose book was Master, Slave, Husband, Wife, which was extraordinary, has made a couple of great lists. She's on the Time Magazine, one of the best 100 books of 2023. And then Smithsonian Magazine just came out and said it's one of the top 10 history books of this year. Fabulous, fabulous book. We love her. We love the book. And our friend David Vondrilli from The Washington Post, who wrote his great field book, one of the top 10 feel good books of the year from the Washington Post, about life with Charlie, his 100-plus-year-old neighbor lived across the street. Those are both fabulous books. Can highly, highly recommend them. And now we're going to talk about Karen Tanabe, who we can recommend till the cows come home. But to do that, Karen, I want Rodney. One of the great things about this show, our Thanksgiving family special, is Rodney custom crafts a cocktail that goes along with the book we're discussing. And they're always good. This one is exceptional. So, Rodney, can you give us a little background for your drink that accompanies The Sunset Crowd by Karen?
This particular challenge was both very difficult and very easy. I say easy because the book, which I love, congratulations, is obviously there are overtones of the lost generation. The Gatsby-esque quality to the book. When you're trying to think of a cocktail, what better genre, what better group of degenerates to focus on than the lost generation, Gatsby, Hemingway, you know, it's on and on. And I thought, what would they drink? But then I kept getting pulled back to, but it's California, 1970s, tequila sunrise. And there is a drink called the tequila sunset. And I thought, how great. The tequila sunset for the Sunset Crowd. I thought, no, that is not creative enough. That is too obvious. And also,
in case you haven't figured this out, listeners, this is an iterative process with Rodney. This
iterative.
Is
No.
So yeah. I decided against the whole tequila sunrise, Don Henley drink, you know, the whole thing. I thought, well, I want to focus on the Gatsby-esque quality. And so I came up with the Hemingway daiquiri, which I thought was, I could imagine the characters in this book sort of, you know, slouching their way to Ensenada rather than Jerusalem, drinking these drinks. And it's a variation of the daiquiri that Hemingway ordered at La Floridita in Havana, because his doctor said if he kept drinking 16 or 20 full sugar daiquiris, he was going to die. And probably die very soon. And so he went in and told the bartender, I want my daiquiri with twice the rum and half the sugar. And that became the Hemingway daiquiri, and which persists to this day. And as Tori said previously, lots of iterations on it, but it's basically white rum, grapefruit juice, and lime juice. And you can gussy it up with a few other things if you'd like, but that's essentially it. And oh, I'm sorry. The one other ingredient, it's really the kicker, is maraschino liqueur.
From the good kind of maraschino cherries.
Not, please, no, ever never buy the red maraschino cherries. That's poison. You buy the real maraschino cherries that have been lovingly tended by monks in Spain for years and, you know, in a cave. Buy those. They're far better. But maraschino liqueur is neither of those. It's actually a liqueur made from cherry pits.
Yeah,
and
delicious.
That's the fourth ingredient. And you bring all together, a little magic happens, serve it in a chilled coupe, and no one will ever not thank you profusely the next day. They may have a hangover, but they will love you for it nonetheless. So
thank you. I can testify it is excellent. It is absolutely excellent. And, you know, my future pending diabetes thanks you as well, because it's not too sweet.
No, it's not too sweet.
Karen, is that the best introduction to your book ever?
I was wondering, Rodney, why you didn't go on book tour with me. Honestly, I really could have used you for spark and your mixology skills while I was in L.A. launching this book. So when the paperback comes out next summer, I'm going to call you.
I'm barred back for hire. Let me know. I'll show up. Ready to go.
I will take you up on it.
Okay, Nevin. I just love this show. It's my favorite, the family Thanksgiving special. You and Karen know each other. Please to explain.
We have a connection in Vassar College. We both went to Vassar, and then we've reconnected actually at a book event held at one of your friends' houses. Wasn't a friend of yours, Karen, that we met somewhere in Georgetown? Gosh, who was it? It was, this was like maybe 8 years ago that we got reconnected. And it was like, I'm still friends, I feel like, with every woman in that book club on Facebook.
Oh,
because
amazing.
It was such a
nice. It was Ada's book club, maybe.
Yes,
Pola,
exactly.
Yeah, who owns Alchemy Forever, the skincare, amazing skincare line. And that's exactly right. And then, Nevin, I saw you in 2022 at reunion at Vassar College on the dance floor. Let's not
you
pretend
did.
That didn't happen.
It was a highlight of 2022.
What kind of moves does Nevin bust on the dance floor, Karen?
I mean, I'm going to be honest. He was kind of hanging with his friends.
Huh?
Then, you know, then the DJ mixologied it up, and there were some good moves.
Nevin. What was Vassar College like when you all were there? And what's it like now? I knew a guy, Matt Brealis, fabulous guy, fantastic journalist. He was in the first or second class of men at Vassar.
And oh, wow.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yeah,
but what was
course.
It like when you all went there, and what's it like now?
Karen, you go first.
I'm just so much younger than Nevin. So just kidding.
That's why I'm letting you take lead.
He went back in his 30s or something like that. Didn't he go back to college when he was in his 30s?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, I really wanted to go to kind of a like glamorous bohemian college with a really good writing history where I didn't have to take much science or math. And then in the like Barron's College guidebook. Do you all remember those?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. The Vassar entry said that everyone wore black and smoked and sat around on benches. And I was like, this is like my calling.
This is your happy place.
This is my happy place. And oh, smoking kills, kids. But you know. Yeah. And then I went, and honestly, I loved it. I loved it. I was like very much a wine and cheese and poetry kind of person, and it really spoke to me. I like wanted to avoid the frats, all that stuff, and it was great for someone like me. How about you, Nevin?
Yeah. Nevin, why did you choose it?
I chose it because they don't have a Greek system.
Yeah.
They don't have a football team, and as Karen adroitly noted, there is no math requirement. There's a quantitative requirement, which you can get out of by taking like a psychology class or something, but there's no math or science requirement. But really it came down to the fact that when I visited the campus for my tour, I instantly felt like I had come home to a place I didn't know I'd ever lived before. And I just, I loved it. I loved it. Like I was the only school I applied to. I applied early, early decision, and I did not have a backup plan.
But that's great. It spoke to you and it worked. Because sometimes, you know, a campus can speak to some young person and then it doesn't work out. That's great.
No. And to be honest, like Vassar is definitely, it's got kind of a metropolitan vibe because it's so close to New York City. And there's so many like New York City expats up there. And definitely a lot of people all in black smoking cigarettes. I was in black, but I didn't smoke cigarettes. But it's funny. It's like, it's got its own quirky personality. The two things that stood out to me at reunion about the way Vassar is today is, one, at around midnight when we were all in the dance tent, all the alumni, suddenly the whole place just goes even crazier than it's already crazy. And everybody runs to the side of the tent and looks across the center of this field. And who should be running by but the Vassar Streaking Club? Like, yeah, just, you know, like 20 random nude people screaming and cheering. So that's like, that's Vassar in a little moment right there. And then the second one is that they now have Quidditch teams. And they have the banners for the Quidditch teams up in the dining hall, which used to be called ACDC, but is now called just the Deece. I'm not cool with that. It's ACDC.
Oh, bad idea.
Yeah. But yeah, Quidditch is now a thing at Vassar.
Oh, good for them. And a streaking club still exists.
That definitely happened when I was there. I don't think you overlap with Dan the Naked Man. Did you, Karen?
It doesn't ring a bell, and I feel like it would.
Oh, it would ring more than a bell. Yeah.
Okay.
It would be triggering.
I'm writing these things down to follow up. Dan, the drinking man? Was that his
name? Naked
man.
No, Dan.
Dan, the naked man. Okay, I'm going to follow up on these things. Okay, yes. Spectacular. When we do Chatter on Colleges, we'll have you two back to talk about this. Okay, Karen, should we talk about this fabulous book, The Sunset Crowd, with, for those watching on News Channel 8, the cover art is spectacular.
Oh, thanks. I love it.
Spectacular. Really love it. Okay, I'm going to ask you the question, Karen, that I've asked other authors before we get into these terrific characters. Every novel now, and I want to figure out when this started, it will say Sunset Crowd, and it's beautiful, a novel. When did they start putting a novel
I think all of mine have said it. And my first novel came out in 2013.
Do you think you started it?
I think I did. No, I think.
Devin, do you know? Rodney, do you know?
My first book, 2013, The List, a novel. It Look said it. So at least 10 years.
Yeah, but it wasn't always. It wasn't always so.
But don't you want to meet the person that is all pissed off because they picked up a book and they thought it was short stories and it was, you know, a novel instead? I mean, can't they just leaf through and see that it's a novel that doesn't stop and start?
Yeah.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
I've checked both Google and ChatGPT, which is Google on steroids. Yeah. And neither one has a good answer to this. Okay, Karen, let's dive into The Sunset Crowd, which, you know, you can never go wrong when reviews start to compare your book to Gatsby. You can never go wrong with that. But I will say this very honestly, very sincerely, when I read the book and I listened to the book, I thought, this is more interesting and has more layers, Sunset Crowd does, than Gatsby.
Oh, you just literally won Person of the Year in my mind.
You got to hang out with some better people, Karen, let me tell you.
No, you're good.
Introduce us to Beatrice, introduce us to Kai, introduce us to Theodora. Tell us who they are and what this is all about.
Yeah, so this book is like very much a mood. I call this book my glamour bomb book. It's like 1977. It's LA. It's kind of this fake it till you make it world. People are trying to make it as be my narrator, kind of the Nick Carraway type character, if you're comparing it to Gatsby, is a photographer for Vogue, for Rolling Stone. She's very much in the in crowd, but always keeps one foot a little ways out. That's why I made her a photographer, a bit behind the lens. And she falls in with this really glamorous group of people. Evra Scott owns like the store in Hollywood. It's basically my dream store. I just created my dream store.
Totally. We're trying to renovate a house in Georgetown right now, Karen. We're failing. And I said, I want that store in Georgetown.
So do I. It's my absolute dream store. Okay. It's, you can buy something cool for $1 or $1,000. Everyone's welcome. Vintage, new, just curated cool. Yep. And then Kai de la Fere is sort of everybody's love interest. He is a movie writer. He is Hawaiian. He is a tall drink of water. And then there's Theodora Lee, who is trying to make it as a producer in Hollywood and may or may not be what she seems. And that's sort of the fun grifter angle.
It's fabulous. And I want to ask a lot about the process, but I know I could be very greedy on the show, so I won't. Rodney, you read, you know what this is about and inspired this spectacular drink, which I'm trying really hard to carefully nurse, but I might be checked out by like 45 into the show. I'm just warning everybody. What'd you think?
I loved it. And that's, Tori, your comparison to Greg Gatsby is apt. And I would put it comparable to the Greg Gatsby. But that's my question. I was fascinated as I read through this. How deliberate were you in taking both themes and some of the character attributes from Gatsby into this book, or did it stop with the narrator, or did you try to build some of that same texture into your other characters?
And I have a follow-up question, but go.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there were three things about Gatsby I really wanted to do. One, the narrator, sort of this like looking back at this thing I lived that was pretty wild. I saw the best in a very flawed person. Two, the flawed person, the grifter quality. That was something I really wanted. The are they real? Are they phony? Very Jay Gatsby quality. And three, looking at America, the way that people make it in America, the way people who maybe start behind others make it in America. And also that question of who gets to be American, you know, in Gatsby, it's very much Daisy and Tom, and they are like these wasp king and queen. And in Hollywood, I have a bunch of people trying to make it who aren't your typical players. And I really like that aspect of the book. And then honestly, I think Gatsby's in my bones. I don't think I meant to make it follow the story so much, but it's my very favorite book. And I don't think I could get away from it once I started.
Okay, here's my follow-up question. And Nevin, maybe this is for you, because as we all know, anybody who's listened to the show, I don't really do the literary thing. I don't really understand the big whatever's constructs of literary accomplishment.
Then make it up.
None of us understand.
Make it up.
Please, Rodney has known me for a long time. That is me. No, here's the question. And this is, okay, you guys, this is going to make sense in a minute. When Ed Sheeran was in the big lawsuit recently, because they were accused of plagiarizing the music.
Yeah.
And it was really, really interesting if you followed it, because he dug deep into a lot of things. And one of the things he said is, in music, there are so many constructs. There are just so many constructs. And it's how you put them together and these kinds of things. And he was talking about how, yes, you're going to find comparisons and parallels and these kinds of things. So here's my question. And Karen, be nice. Nevin gets to tackle it first, and then you can Nevin. Yes. No, here's my question. I really, really have enjoyed every iteration of Great Gatsby, reading it, watching, you know, different versions, et cetera. I think it has two or three layers. And I think Karen's book, The Sunset Crowd, Karen, on a podcast, every time someone mentions the name of the book, you sell a copy.
Oh, The Sunset Crowd? Yes. Amazing.
So Nevin, in The Sunset Crowd, like your time.
Yes. Tell me.
Are there basic literary constructs that are going to be there? Or has she taken something like The Great Gatsby and made it much more interesting and much more complex? I know what I think.
Whoa. Well, first of all, we're talking about The Sunset Crowd. So an angel just got his wings.
We should have a little bell on the show, just a little ding.
You should. Obviously, your love for the book just shot through the whole project. But you obviously made something that's completely your own. I mean, don't we all stand on the shoulders of giants? I think like it's okay to take influence from one very specific text, but then build out a whole world and a whole imagination just from there. So I think that there's so much more. I think to just say it's just this one thing would be cheapening it and be a terrible thing to say. So no, I'd say so many more layers, Karen, so many more layers in The Sunset Crowd.
Ding. Okay, Karen, the 70s. I are a child of the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to say 70s and 80s, as Rodney knows, it's really the 70s. And you are so good, as we learned from 100 Sons and some of your previous books. You are just a master genius with historical fiction. I know you do tons and tons of research. And so as I'm reading The Sunset Crowd, ding, I'm Google checking, I'm ChatGPT checking and these kinds of things, because I knew some of the cultural references, the music, the cocaine, a little less personal experience there, but lots of things. And I'm checking going, bam, she nailed it. Bam, she nailed it. So why the 70s? Why was that the decade you were interested in? And how did you, because you're a child, you are much younger, you and your Vassar crowd. Why the 70s? And what was the research you did to just nail it?
Yeah, I wanted a time where women had some freedom in career, you know. The book I wrote before this, A Woman of Intelligence, with the 50s.
Yeah. Right.
Tough to give women flourishing careers in the 50s because the world didn't let them. the 70s, a lot more opportunities for women. So yeah. That was a big thing. And I just like fashion-wise and music-wise, yeah. I love the 70s. Like, put me in yeah. Halston and Yves Saint Laurent all the time, constantly. Right. So I think aesthetically, I knew I wanted to do this store. The 70s really spoke to me. Uh-huh. There was sort of a freedom to the 70s. Not that there weren't very difficult things going on, but this is like pre-AIDS, you know, post-birth yeah. control. So I really wanted this era, lots of drugs, where yeah. you could kind of live this wild child life while still, you know, really trying to climb that ladder of success.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked. And as for LA, I thought about a few other cities, and my agent, when I told her DC, was like, absolutely not Ooh. DC. Everyone yeah. is so sick of DC.
Oh,
I know.
Fair point, though. So yeah. what was your research process like, you know, aside from just drawing on the things that you already loved about that era?
Yeah. Yeah. A ton. Like, I, as you said, thank you, Tori. I was a journalist, so I love the research. I mean, the first thing you do is read all the big books from the 70s. So I read all the big books. I read the LA Times from the 70s. The actual day I'm writing about, I'll read the paper, Wait. You know, Rolling Stone, I'd read the magazines. And then I talk to actual people. I mean, everyone who I could talk to, I talked to about their lives. And it's funny, like, just a few comments will change everything. Like, one of my friends said, oh, you know, in LA, you don't sell a condo, you sell an apartment, you know, and these like little jargon things.
Yeah, yeah.
So hyper specific. And then I bought roadmaps from the 70s, because if you got a road wrong, an LA person will absolutely eviscerate you.
Yes.
And then I had a ton of people from LA of different age ranges read my book. To just fact.
Okay, wait. I want to ask you about Susan Strait, Karen. Hi, David. You're looking like you're in Star Wars, or
I am so very, very sorry.
Well, you're looking very handsome. Where are you?
Yeah. I'm at Capital One Arena. I'm working.
Oh, for those watching on Channel 8, David is looking very spiffy in a blazer.
Oh, the moron of morons. I am so sorry.
Just have to say Sunset Crowd three times really fast, because then Karen will sell three more books. So just do it.
Sunset Crowd, Sunset Crowd, Sunset Crowd. Sunset Crowd, Sunset Crowd, Sunset Crowd. You sell twice as many books.
Wow.
That's what I'm here for.
David, do you remember Susan Strait, great author?
I do, yes. Mecca? Yes.
Mecca. Absolutely. Okay, Karen, you have got to meet Susan Strait, and you two should mind meld, because Susan is spectacular. Her last book was Mecca, fantastic. Susan knows California like nobody knows California.
Susan's one of the best authors we've had. I love her.
Yeah, one of the best. God, remember her map? She did this thing, this geographical thing. It blew up everybody's preconceptions. Okay, now we're digressing. preconceptions about who reads, you know, if you live here, this is what you read. She blew it up. But anyways, Mecca is real Californians. And same, I mean, she's lived it, but it was the same kind of thing. You had to get on this road. This is the kind of mesquite that grows on the side of the road. And again, Karen, I Google checked and ChatGPT checked and you went back and looked at my t-shirt collection from the 70s to see if you got everything so right, which was so cool. Of your wonderful characters in the book, The Sunset Crowd, Beatrice, the photographer, and okay, wait a minute, question. I have so many questions. Nevin, you, the man of many talents, the Renaissance man, photographer. Uh-oh. Talk about and that was one of my many failed careers. I tried for two and a half years, failed. But I appreciate the role of a photographer. And Karen, again, you nail the perspective. Yeah. People, if somebody's a really, really good photographer, they prefer being behind the lens than in front of it. So Nevin, do you share that? That's the protagonist of the story.
I know. Well, it's funny you should bring this up, because we had this whole argument in my family about how we have a beautiful photo album of our family, except there's one person that's missing, and it's me. I'm not okay with it, but I'm also okay with it in the sense that I would love pictures with the people that I love, but I also love taking good pictures of the people that I love, because for the first part of my life, my dad took terrible pictures of all of us, and we have just trashy childhood photos, and I don't want that to happen to my family. I appreciate the role of the photographer, but it's also interesting because it's like the one person you can almost forget is there, but they're the person that's in charge of memorializing it. And so they're, in fact, they're like the most invisible person is sometimes the most important person, you know, and I think you do a really good job of capturing that kind of element of a character. I'll leave it at that. And I'm not trying to pat myself on the back by saying I'm the most important character in my family. I mean, as a literary device.
Oh, I know your family, Nevin. You're not. You're not. Just,
I'm a distant 22nd in the
exactly.
family.
Karen, this I actually think making Beatrice a photographer was brilliant because of all the reasons Nevin said. And again, this is why I'm putting this above The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
What do you know about photography? And why did you know that would be a really interesting, effective role for your protagonist to have?
Yeah, I know very little about photography, which is why I spoke to my photographer friends and asked them every single thing about what they do. And then I read a bunch of books of photographers talking about their process.
Uh-oh.
And I'm an over-researcher. Like, I want to cast a giant net for just a little.
Sure.
Because it makes me feel better, honestly. It makes me feel like I'm writing in a more assured way. But I also realized that if I had a photographer, they could also kind of sleuth through photographs a bit.
Mm.
So there's a scene where B takes a picture of Kai, the Hawaiian heartthrob, doing a backflip in the pool, and everyone's flinching from the water coming up and like they're turning away from the camera. And Theodora, who's our grifter, is just staring at him, not moving. And she prints this photo and she studies it. And she's like, what's with this woman? Like, look at this intensity. Mm-hmm. So it was a neat device to sort of solve pieces of the puzzle also.
It was a great device. And Rodney first, and then David, I have a question for you. Rodney, I don't think I've seen this device anywhere else. It was a spectacular device. And maybe my failed career as a photographer, you need to know something about it. But I just thought, wow, that is such a great device to use. Device is too small a word. And I really appreciate it. But Rodney, your vast experience with the men's book club, a photographer, have they played roles that you can recall?
Mm.
Oh, have photographers played roles in the book you read? That is a fabulous question. I was in a movie club for a while, and the movie that this reminded me of is one of my favorite movies, Boogie Nights.
Oh, yeah.
Great movie.
That took a left turn.
The 70s. Yeah. And if you remember Boogie Nights, a decent amount of the movie was made was the film, not the dirty bits, as the Brits would say, but some of the interesting stuff in the movie were like pseudo. They made the pseudo documentary. I don't know if you remember this part of the movie. And it was so unbelievably cringy because it had these people. Mark Wahlberg playing Dirk Diggler, one of the great characters, talking about how important the characterization was, and it was ludicrous, but it was shot in this sort of 8mm kind of stuff. And I thought about that when I read about the photographer, that sometimes so much exposition happens when you show a character through a lens or a movie camera as part of, or in your case, Karen, being able to describe the distance that creates, I thought was fabulous. And, you know, it had a happier ending than Boogie Nights, but we're not maybe not happier, but different.
Okay. I've thought of it. And then I have a question for David. Rear Window. Remember Jimmy Stewart?
Yeah.
Sure.
David, you've been in camera as my children
unfortunately
let me know is in case I haven't said this enough. The reason my 20 somethings, two boys and one young woman, talk to me is because I know David Aldridge. So you've been in front of the camera, David. It's true. You've been in front of the camera many times. You've essentially been behind the camera. You have, you know, obviously interviewed the greatest and the best and whatever. Which do you prefer and why?
Oh, God, I prefer behind. I'm a writer. I just was on TV for a while. That's how I've always thought of it. I don't like being in front of the camera. I mean, I tolerate it.
Why not? Why not?
The things you have to do to be on television, I don't like doing on a regular basis. I just, it's not me. It's not for me. The kind of self-promotion, self-preening things, that's just not me. I mean, I don't think I'm the best reporter in the world. I don't think I'm the best writer in the world. I don't think I'm the most handsome man in the world. And then you have to kind of play to that a little bit on TV, to be on TV a lot, and that's just not me. I prefer talking to other people. And this is what I wanted to ask Karen, was your career as a reporter. You obviously knew a lot of photographers and knew a lot of people. And I just wonder, it's such, I always found writing to be a very kind of solitary, lonely kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Because even if you're working with editors, it's still your words and how you want to shape it. And I wonder how that informed you when you wrote the character of the photographer.
Great question.
Yeah, I did get to spend a lot of time with photographers, which was great. And they are all sorts of people. It's a more artistic, you know, career. You're not dying to be in front of the spotlight, right, like you said. But one of the coolest assignments I had when I was at Politico was interviewing the photographer who took the guys raising the flag on 9/11. He took that picture.
Oh, wow. Yeah, sure.
And it was great. I talked to him for a long time. And he told me, he was like, you know, I didn't take that picture and think I got the shot. I took so many pictures that day. I didn't think it was more special than anything else. He said it wasn't until I got home and was looking through all of them very quickly, obviously this is all happening very quickly, that I thought, oh, like this could be something. And then it printed again and again and again and again. Yeah. But like, I think, so I definitely, that was in my brain when I had my photographer character be surprised by some of the shots she took.
I find that fascinating because I've known a lot of photographers, love them and admire them and respect them. And there's a famous photograph from the 60s by a guy named Bernie Boston, happens to share my birthday, May 18th. And it is, you can Google it, Bernie Boston, Vietnam. And it's a photograph of, it's about the protests against Vietnam. And it was a hippie. There's no other way to describe the guy. Beautiful blonde hair, wearing this big fuzzy sweater. And he's putting a daisy down the end of the rifle.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Bernie took that shot and he goes, I got it. He knew. He absolutely knew. And then David Kennerly, maybe the youngest ever Pulitzer Prize winner for photography, has had some incredible shots. Same kind of thing. He's like, I knew it. I mean, I think sometimes they do. I think sometimes they really do know that they've gotten something that was particularly special and unique and these kinds of things. Okay, Karen, we could keep you here. I could keep you here for 1,000 years. I'm going to get you out of this. And David, and we'll do an alphabetic order. David, Nevin, Rodney. I'm not good at the alphabet.
Wow, that was a journey.
It was a struggle. Fake it till you make it. As David knows, Karen, I go apoplectic with Elizabeth Holmes, Sam Bankman-Fried. Mm-hmm. I go absolutely, you know, Anna Delvey. I go absolutely apoplectic about these people who fake it until they make, and they make it for a long time, and they make a lot of money and fame and fortune, and they get caught. And that there's a thread in this wonderful book, Sunset Crowd, ding, about fake it till you make it. How do you feel about it? And did you deliberately put that in there?
I did. I think it's very American. I think it's a really American thing. I think
what
it's
does
amazing.
That say about us? What does that say about us, Karen?
You know, it says we're dreamers. Honestly, I don't see it as a terrible thing. Yes, the Elizabeth Holmes is, if you're like really like screwing people, obviously that's extremely bad. But like, I do think there's a dreamer quality in America where you're like, if I just act like I know what I'm doing and I pretend that this is like bigger than it is, it actually, I'll manifest it and it will happen. And like, I've certainly done that in my life. Speaking of like David said about doing TV, when I was at Politico, they'd pop you in the middle of the newsroom on an elevated chair and you'd have to do the news. And I didn't know what I was talking about. I just, if I say this in a convincing manner with like, you know, people are going to believe me. And it's not like it was lies. It was just like, how am I going to present it in a way that people want to watch me again on TV? And like, you know, I think there's just a certain like chutzpah you have to have when you're writing, where you're like, my words matter so much that they're going to be put in a book and people are going to buy it. Like, why do my words matter that much? Like, everybody's smart and could write a book, but you got to just be like, you know what? It does matter, and I'm great at this, and here I am to
do it. So. I'm lying. Best David, answer. You're first. David's first. Fake it till you make it.
What's the question?
Fake it till you make it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's, I think we can say with some certainty that the last 10 years of our country is a testament to fake it till you make it. That's pretty clear. So, you know, obviously there's a certain amount of truth to that. And there are people who are more than willing to lie. It's probably a strong word, but, you know, to augment whatever they believe reality is. And there's unfortunately a great number of people who want to believe things that they know aren't true. For whatever reasons, they love it.
I had not thought about this in my copious notes before, but David, this is great because now I have conversations for Thanksgiving here in Sperryville with past thousands of relatives. No, this is really good. And David, this is one, David, I have a moment here. This is one of the reasons I love sports. You can only fake it so far.
Well, that's true.
You can only fake it so far.
At some point, you do have to be able to do the things that you're required to do. But even in sports, there are people who are very good at deception. I mean, there's some. But in terms of the actual skill level, and of course, this is not what Karen is here to talk about at all. But it is true. Talent wins out. You have to be able to actually play.
Over the long run, there's always, in my world, there's always politics. Okay, for chatter on sports, which Claude is going to produce soon. Okay, Nevin, your comments on fake it till you make it. And then Ronnie.
When I think of fake it till you make it, what I think of is the flip side of that coin, which is imposter syndrome.
Sure.
Which is all these people that are so afraid that they aren't good enough, that they push themselves even harder and can't see in themselves the things that they have done that are worth seeing. You know, that to me is always a really interesting story. Fake it till you make it. I always wonder, why are you doing this? Are you doing this to make yourself or to fake everybody else, in the sense that, like, are you trying to get something that doesn't really belong to you? And that's a long conversation if we're going to go down the political road that David brought up. But, you know, for me, I think a lot about imposter syndrome, because I feel like that's something that pretty much every writer that I know, myself included, has struggled with at the beginning, middle, or even, you know, contemporaneously in their careers. So I'm always interested to know why people don't think that their words matter enough, even when they're getting books published, even when they're writing cover stories,
sure,
even when their words are making news.
Right.
I'm always intrigued by that.
Way early on in Chatter on Books fame, David, you've probably forgotten this, but he sent me this really interesting article about authors who had their first book out called a novel, tremendous success and acclaim and everything else, and then, you know, fell off the face of the earth. And I reached out to some of the authors that were in the story, and they could barely even talk to me. And it was all about imposter syndrome. Okay, Rodney, imposter syndrome?
Well, it's a fascinating question, Tori. And in many ways, that is the bedrock, the foundation under which lie books like The Great Gatsby. It's even more pervasive than any one manifestation. I mean, I look at, like, but it has two sides. That's why it's such a fascinating question. There are imposters like the Elizabeth Holmes that are so clearly preposterously fakes. But there are some, you may or may not know this, one of my personal heroes is Ulysses S. Grant, which is very hard, takes a lot of courage to be from Alabama and have Ulysses S. Grant be the hero. But if you read Chernoff's great, great book about him, in many ways, he was a fake at the beginning of his military success. He did not distinguish himself at West Point. He was a failed businessman. Everything he did was a failure. And yet they bring him back into the Army at the beginning of the Civil War. And it was almost everybody, the chattering class in Washington, oh, who's this drunk? He doesn't know what he's doing. It's a disaster. And yet he had deep anxiety and deep imposter syndrome. And yet he decided, I'm going to do the one thing I know how to do. And that's find the enemy, fight the enemy. And then when that fight finished, find him again and fight him again. And he wasn't sophisticated. He wasn't fancy. And in many ways, according to the dictates of the mid-19th century military doctrine, he was sort of an imposter in a way. And yet he saved the United States and democracy and played a not small role in freeing the slaves and is a towering figure. So point being, sometimes in the American story, fakes or imposters just decide, you know what, I'm going to do this thing that I know how to do, and everyone's going to think I'm an imposter, and I'm going to just keep doing it and succeed. Sometimes I don't, thank God. Sometimes they do. And that's why I think it's a fascinating area of inquiry to look at, because American history is full of those people, right? That did succeed. I mean, imposters at some real level, but they actually succeeded.
That's awesome. Again, a really good host. We just like ended on that because that was really wonderful, but I won't. But that speaks to why Karen wrote this book, I think, because the imposter syndrome is important. It's important to life. It's important to people. It's important to history. So it's great. Okay, Karen, I'm going to do this to you because I've never done this ever. I've never read somebody's blurb or somebody's review or these kinds of things, but I'm going to say this. I'm going to read this about Sunset Crowd, partly because the person who reviewed Sunset Crowd for the Washington Post was Carrie Marr, who's been on the show. Paris bookseller, which is fantastic. And this is what she said. And then Karen, you're going to get out with this, but you're not going to get out of 60 seconds more. In our days, this is Carrie, in our days of Insta everything, where cool is watered down by likes and dislikes and anyone can become an influencer, this novel reminds us that cool used to be hard to attain and that LA cool is different from New York cool, which is different from Can cool. The Sunset Crowd is cool sans hangover. I will speak to that tomorrow morning. is cool sans hangover, which makes it a perfect addition to your summer luggage.
Ooh.
How'd you feel when you read that one, Karen?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I read that review and then I just sat there in a chair and stared at the paper and was like, did I just get this review? Is this happen? It was a dream review. And I read that book and I think she's so smart. So to have someone so intelligent write it meant a lot. And you know, you always are just hoping people kind of get your book. And I felt like she really, really got it. And I did want to make this book very cool. Honestly, like I was in the mood for cool. The pandemic was not cool, my friends. And all of a sudden I was like, I want glamour. I want cool. Let's do it. And I agree. Like cool has changed and it's easier to fake it. And it was harder back in the day. So. It was fun to write.
Excellent.
You can tell.
Okay. The book is The Sunset Crowd. It's fabulous. Read it, listen to it, all these kinds of things.
Hey, Chatterheads. It's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
All right, everybody. This is just one of my favorite shows ever. Just love it, love it, love it. The book is The Sunset Crowd. It's the holiday season, everybody. Go out and buy this book by Karen Tanabe. It is at your favorite independent bookseller anywhere. Just go buy the book. David, I'm going to tee you up because we are off next week so we can all recover from Thanksgiving. And I'm going to make about 18 more versions of Rodney's drink here. We have Ann Foster back with us in early December. Tell us how you know her. And I just read this morning, you read many drafts of her book and provided a lot of good news about her.
I did. Mm-hmm. Ann is one of my best friends in the world. Full disclosure. We went to American University together. We were both history majors. She's brilliant. She's the smartest person I've ever met. And she is a professor now, a full professor at Indiana State University. She teaches history. And she's written a wonderful book called The War on Drugs, that is about the whole history of drug interdiction policy in the United States going back to the 1800s, why certain drugs became popular, why certain drugs became sellable, and why certain drugs became dangerous and banned, and just kind of like the impact over the last century and a half of drug policy, and especially in the United States. It's
and based on the
war on drugs.
Based on the drafts I've seen, fascinating, so smart. And she drew on and used the experience and help of a lot of her students to help her write it.
Yes.
Very much looking forward to that.
Yep.
Okay, Lauren, if you're still with us, thank you very much for making this happen. Rodney, I hope to see you over the holidays. Nevin, I'm going to find you because you're going to be in Rappahannock County, so I got to find you.
I would love that. Please find me.
David, love you. David, wait, are you excited about American almost beating Georgetown yesterday?
Oh, it was so sad. We should have won the game. We had the game won and we lost.
It was
Karen fabulous. Does not want to hear this. She is.
She's
like, why was I booked?
Is that the one with the ball? Is that
Yeah, it's a round thing. Karen, everybody, the book is The Sunset Crowd. Go out and buy it. It's fabulous. Karen, thank you so much. And everybody, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Hope you have a happy and healthy and safe Thanksgiving. And we will see you soon.